Great. So we're living in an unprecedented time of wild plant biodiversity loss. PIM and co-authors estimate that 30% of plants are threatened with extinction. The same authors contend that current rates of extinction in plants, measured as extinctions per million species years, are three orders of magnitude greater than background extinction rates measured over geologic time. Now, those two pieces of information, coupled with the fact that humans depend on plants, should be alarming to anybody. And it's not that we're just losing rare and endangered species. We're also losing crop wild relatives that contain important genetic information. We're losing undiscovered species that form networks that provide important ecological services. And we're losing, excuse me, we're losing many plants that hold promise as medicines, foods, fibers, and for aesthetic reasons. Now, this loss of wild plant biodiversity is as important to me now as it was over 20 years ago when I got into, when I really got interested in plant conservation and restoration. And one of the important lessons that I learned early on was that seeds are critical for the success of in situ and ex situ conservation programs. But at the same time, I was hearing a message that was almost diametrically opposed to what I was learning here early on. And that was that many plant conservation and restoration programs fail or are limited in some way because we have this wide gap in wild plant seed biology understanding. So we know what plants to work with and where we want to be and what we want to do, but it's hard to get to the other side because we have a lack of understanding of basic seed biology of a lot of wild plants. And there's many reasons why this may be occurring. Dr. Tacroni in 2006 published an article in Crop Science outlining the disturbing trend of loss of academic seed science programs throughout land-grant institutions in the United States, and it's a trend that's continuing today. If we take another perspective and look at it from a land management viewpoint, what we see is that workload exceeds human capacity to actually carry out a lot of this work. And what I mean by that, if we look at the BLM, Bureau of Land Management, between 2002 and 2013, they had 68 botanists on staff. Those 68 botanists were responsible for 264 million acres. Folks, that's about 3.9 million acres per botanist. And to put that into perspective, that's an area larger than the state of Connecticut. Okay? The U.S. Forest Service, 128 botanists. 191 million acres under their care, about 1.5 million acres per botanist. That's, anyone know what state that is? Delaware, there you go. So it's an area a little bit smaller than the state of Delaware. Now, I don't have data for land management at the state level, but I do interact a lot with state land managers, and I can tell you that the story is the same. So you have a handful of land managers that are responsible for hundreds of thousands or millions of acres. And if any of you do gardening at home or mow the lawn on the weekend or pay somebody to mow the lawn on the weekend because you know how much work it is, think about how much effort goes into keeping your vegetable garden and your garden looking good, your landscape looking good, and start ramping that up. Start scaling that up from 1 acre to 10 acres to 100 acres to 1,000 acres. And what you quickly see is that there's no way that people that are responsible for managing so much land have any time to do native plant seed research. Another startling statistic is that 50% of those federal botanists that I was talking about earlier plan to retire by 2019. And if we look at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, 43% of all U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service employees that are in charge of recovering plants plan to retire by 2020. And again, the message is the same at the state level. I see a lot of gray hairs in my colleagues at the state land management agencies. I know they're going to be retiring pretty soon. And also, we're losing a lot of our academic scientists as well. We're expecting another wave of retirements here within the next 5 years from a lot of our academic seed researchers. So there's this brain drain going on that I think is leading to some of this lack of knowledge in a lot of the wild plants that we work with. In terms of funding is always going to be a challenge. And if we just look at species that are federally listed as endangered species, what we see is that about 60% of those are plants and about 43% are animals. So we have way more plants listed for protection But if you look at the funding that they receive, it's minuscule compared to what animals receive. So in 1997, total expenditures were over $266 million, but plants only received about $10.6 million of recovery funds. And what you have to remember is that there's 8 districts of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and there's many states and territories within those districts, so that $10.6 million has to be cut up between those districts. So funding is meager, and there's a downward trend in recovery expenditures as well. So in 2007, the story is the same. Plants received about $10.5 million for recovery efforts. At the state level, again, I don't have data, but I can tell you from my experience that funding at the state level for plant restoration and conservation programs is meager. Another way of looking at this is from an industry perspective. So we did a survey back in 2011, and we asked native plant industry producers or wildflower people that are producing wildflowers and using seeds of wild plants, what was important to them in terms of what their needs were. And what came out on top was that what they needed most was seed biology data. And it's pretty simple stuff, you know, just looking at germination, storage information, dormancy conditions, and seed conditioning. And they rated those very highly. So there's this big need by the industry for more research in wild plants, and specifically with seed biology. But what they tell us is they don't have the resources to conduct that research and development. So there's this gap also at the industry, from the industry perspective, that we can't fill the need in terms of needed information because the industry does not have the resources to do that. So what we see is that there's a complex, multi-layered set of obstacles when it comes to wild plant seed research. And if I'm being honest, it could be frustrating to think about these obstacles. But as Michael Jordan once said, obstacles don't have to stop you. If you run into a wall, don't turn around and give up. Figure out how to climb it, go through it, or work around it. And that's what I've been doing for the last 11 years at the University of Florida with my wild plant seed research program. I haven't done it alone. I've had a lot of great mentors and colleagues along the way, a lot of motivated graduate students, and good relationships with different agencies to help make that research program happen. So my research program focuses on 3 main themes: germination ecology, abiotic stress tolerance, and seed quality variation. With the first theme, what we try to do is understand how climate, more specifically a changing climate, influences dormancy and germination dynamics. In terms of the second theme, what we're trying to do is understand what enables seeds to tolerate different levels of abiotic stress. And we're mostly focusing on looking at aging stress, thermal stress, and desiccation stress. And then finally, we're really interested in understanding why seed quality varies so much in seeds of native plants. And I really enjoy this research program because we get to straddle both fundamental aspects of research and applied aspects of research. One of the groups of plants that I was really fond of working with were the Hawaiian Pochardia palms. The interesting thing about this is that most of the Hawaiian palms are endemic to certain parts of the Hawaiian Islands. Almost all of them are listed as federally endangered. And what I did is I worked on several areas, so looking at how seed predation influences germination dynamics. Did a lot of work in terms of germination ecology, so dissecting out what the dormancy mechanisms are in this particular group of palms and understanding germination phenology and germination timing. And then I spent a lot of time trying to understand the desiccation tolerance of the embryos. And the reason for that is that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife needed this information in an effort to try and meet recovery goals. Let me focus a little bit on the desiccation tolerance work that we did. So again, we focused on embryos, and we did a developmental study. And we looked at things such as dry matter accumulation, changes in water relations throughout development, and we actually were able to visualize cellular architecture and how that changes throughout the developmental program. Now, that's not new stuff. People have done that in the past. But what I think really makes this work stand out is this model of allowable cell shrinkage that we came up with. And this work is predicated on a model that Chris Walters and Karen Koster developed earlier, but we had a great opportunity here to apply it to Pochardia. And essentially what we're doing is trying to find out how the accumulation of dry matter and changes in water relations throughout the seed affect cellular volume changes. Now, in order to understand that, we have to understand some work by Merriman and Stepankis. And what those research groups found was that there's lethal mechanical stress induced when cellular volume is reduced by 50 to 65%. Okay, so cells can't recover from that level of damage if cellular volume is reduced by that much. So this red rectangle of cell death represents that range of cell volume change. On the x-axis, we have reduction in cellular volume. On the y-axis, we have days of embryo development. And I'm just showing 100 days of development, which is pretty early in the developmental program, and 340 days of development, which is a point after mass maturity. And we use different points here of induced water stress. And what we see is that when there's really mild water stress occurring, we don't expect to see much volume change at either one of those developmental points. But notice what happens here at 100 days of development. So if we induce stress associated with minus 5 megapascals or minus 15 megapascals, notice where those what that leads to in terms of cellular volume reduction. So we're already in the lethal range early in development. And this is associated with the fact that at this stage of development, the cells have not accumulated enough dry matter to buffer those changes in reductions of cell volume. Later on in development, after the embryos have accumulated as much dry matter as they can, they've reached mass maturity, what we see is that when we induce desiccation at minus 5 or minus 15 megapascals, we're not having as much of a reduction in cell volume as we do earlier in the program. So those cells are able to buffer some of those mechanical stresses associated with drying. But if we go a little bit further and calculate what happens when we stress the seeds at what's called the critical water potential, which in this case is minus 49 megapascals, what we see is that we are in that range of cell death due to cellular volume reductions. Now, this is important because if we were to try and store these tissues using international gene bank standards, we'd have to dry those embryos down in equilibrium with 15% relative humidity. And that translates to about minus 260 megapascals. So we can see that, yes, the seeds are able to tolerate some level of desiccation, but not tolerate the level of desiccation that we need in order to store these tissues for long-term conservation purposes. And in fact, what we're saying is that in order for cells of any plant, of any seed or embryo, to be able to buffer those changes, more than 35% of the cell volume must be made up of dry matter reserves. When you have that level of dry matter reserves, you do get some reduction in cell volume, but it's not going to be catastrophic to the membranes of those embryos. So we've done some work in this area. We spent a lot of time working with native wildflowers in the region as well. We've done a lot of work, so I'm not going to go into detail for all those, but I just want to highlight some of the work that we've done with some of these species. So up here, Uniola paniculata, or sea oats. If you've had a chance to go to the beach while you're here, you may have seen this. If there's a dune at the beach where you're walking along, if you get the chance to do a little sunset walk on the beach while you're here, go for it, and you'll see sea oats there. But we looked at the desiccation and cryo-freezing tolerance of seeds across the latitudinal range in Florida. And what we find with these species, the seeds are tough as nails, very desiccation tolerant. They tolerate cryo-freezing. But we found something interesting. We found that seeds from southwest Florida, from Naples, about 2 hours south of here, have more shallow dormancy than seeds from north Florida, from the Jacksonville area. And most people think, oh, you're in Florida, the weather's the same, the climate's the same no matter where you go in Florida. But there are differences between those two parts of the state in terms of dryness and freezing. So we see slight differences in the expression of dormancy in seeds of sea oats. Wiregrass is another important species that we've worked with. Here, most of the work is focused on germination ecology and trying to understand if the seeds form soil seed banks. We can say without a doubt that these do not form soil seed banks. They germinate pretty much any time of the year, and they don't appear to be shed from the parent plant with any dormancy mechanisms. Another important aspect of this work was that a lot of practitioners were coming to us and saying, look, we're getting highly variable results. We've been seeing this for 35, 40 years. What the heck is going on? We think it has to do with infection of seeds with fungus. And in the work that we did, we collected seeds from all over the southeastern United States. And yet, there is some presence of fungal contamination in the seeds. But really, what's driving viability loss in these is the production of a high volume of aborted seeds, which we're not clear on why this is happening, but it's happening nonetheless. With plants like Aragrostis eliotii and Gallardia pulchella, what we're finding is that those seeds are highly resistant to aging stress. Gallardia pulchella, again, the seeds are very desiccation tolerant. With the seeds of Ipomopsis rubra, a couple of Polygamma species, Baldwina angustifolia, and Rudbeckia mollis, we've done a lot of work trying to figure out the thermal limits of germination and try to understand if there's any dormancy mechanisms associated with those species. And what we're finding, if dormancy is present, it's shallow, non-deep physiological dormancy. But what's interesting, when we look at the thermal limits of germination, what we see is that small increases in temperatures that are associated with germination have a profound and large impact in terms of germination timing and seed viability. And we think that's important given what's expected to happen with climate change. So most of the work on seed biology with regards to climate change occurs in temperate regions or on mountains. So a lot, the feeling I get is that people are ignoring what's happening in other parts of the country or other parts of the world that might be warm and temperate. But what we're seeing is that it doesn't matter. Even small temperature increases have a big impact on germination dynamics, and that's important in terms of population fitness. I had a graduate student that just finished doing some work with Harpocallis flava, which is a little bog plant from the panhandle of Florida. It's an endangered species. And the word on the street was that this plant did not produce viable seeds, and there was no seedling recruitment in the wild whatsoever. And we said, okay, give us a chance. Let's take a look at it. And we were able to show that, nope, the plant produces a very high proportion of viable seeds. Germination is delayed, and we see that delay in germination is due to a morphological dormancy. And also, we were able to find that seedling recruitment it wasn't high because we're dealing with a very harsh environment here, but seedling recruitment did happen. And we also know that this species can also form soil seed banks. We're really interested to try and understand how light, different qualities of light, influence embryo growth in this particular species. I have another graduate student that did some work with Rudbeckia mollis. And he took a functional trait approach to try and understand how seed size or how different types of stress are influenced by seed size. So what he did is he collected achenes of Rudbeckia mollis at maturity and sorted them into different size classes. And interestingly, what he found is that the smaller seeds are much better able to tolerate aging stress and thermal stress. So they maintain a high level of germination despite the same level of stress that's given to the other size classes. They maintain their germination rate and their viability, and what we see is that we get viability loss with those larger size classes. We haven't figured out why this is the case, but he is working on that for his PhD, and we're trying to get some answers on that. So we've done a lot of work with with wild plants. There's still a lot more work to go. I've been working with my grad students to develop a new project that's the UFC research project. We've gone through the ideation stage, we've built our logic model, and the next step is to build a 1-to-2-page strategic plan that's usable. The premise of this project is to first organize all the data that we do have and make it readily available to practitioners so that we could start filling that knowledge gap. And then we hope to be able to use this project to ask larger questions in terms of wild plant seed biology, and maybe down the road be able to use it as a project to be able to get some more funding. So the title slide of this presentation said, "So what?" And it made a statement, why wild plant seed research matters. I want to turn that into a question really quickly. In my view, the work that we're doing and colleagues all around the state and all around the country are doing is it matters because we're starting to fill that knowledge gap in wild plant seed research that's so important for the success of conservation and restoration programs. I also think that we're chipping away at relieving some of that capacity burden that we see with colleagues at land management institutions. And I'm not naive to think that we have all the answers to all the questions right now. And I know that we have a lot more work to do. But I can tell you that the managers that I work with are really appreciative of any information that they're getting. And in fact, they tell me that the information that we translate for them, it helps enhance decision-making for restoration and conservation programs. So I'd like to leave you with this quote by Teddy Roosevelt, and he says, "Far and away, the best prize that life has to offer is the chance to work hard at work worth doing." So we've definitely been working hard with research of wild plants, and I hope I've been able to convince you that that's work worth doing. So thank you very much. So those were calculations that Chris and Karen had come up with, and you might have to help me out on this one. Surface area, so we're using surface area.
Mostly through the isotherms, assuming that water, the volume of water.
Right, so. So for the less negative solutions, it was with PEG, and then we calculated the what the change would be at minus 49, so we didn't actually dry them down to that level, but with PEG solutions. But in other work that we've done, yes, when we go drier than about minus 12 megapascals, then we use the saturated salt solutions.
That's
a great question. I think it's going to be, it's not necessarily related to what type of dry matter it is, but to the volume that dry matter occupies in the seed. Now, Chris might have another opinion on that, but I think it's more related just to the overall volume of dry matter that's accumulated in the seeds.
I'll just add a little bit. I mean, we are thinking that it is important in terms of the compressibility of that dry matter. So that's where the lipids come in. Lipids become very, very compressible around their phase transition temperatures. And so we see associations of lipids with poor storage when you put them in the freezer. Yeah, thank you.
Well, I don't know if this is related to the question before, but if we look at wild
I'm going to defer to you on that one.
It's a lot more complicated than the question that you presented because it depends on if you go dry to wet, wet to dry, the history. We can make this more complicated than anything. But yes, there's an absolute relationship between the lipid material and what the lipid properties are and the compressibility. Absolutely. And it is temperature dependent, as one can imagine. And it's not just Prochardia has very small lipids, but they're very saturated lipids, so it's much more prone to high temperatures. Whereas most of our wild types are linoleic acid, so not so temperature dependent in the freezer.
Are other wild areas in the U.S. tracking similar things, or are you low ranges?
Riding in on my horse. Yeah. So what I've noticed is that there's this wall or shield around the southeastern United States. There's a lot of work being done in the Intermountain region, California, Pacific Northwest. There's even some work in upper Midwest and New England. But when it comes to the southeast, there's, and I don't know why, maybe it's because we don't have a lot of BLM lands, or, you know, I don't know what it is, but it just seems like not too many people in my region are doing any of this type of work. There's a lab in Georgia, a dry branch lab. I think it's a USDA facility, or Forest Service. They do some work in this area. And I have colleagues at Fairchild Tropical Botanical Garden and Bach Tower that do some germination work and storage work as well. But for the most part, there's a handful of us, I would say at the most, that are doing this type of work in the southeast.
Have you ever considered, like, the germination, the effect of the natural microbiome in the site?
Oh.
Like promoting germination. So you talked about disease, having a fungi, but some of those are beneficial, maybe, and whether, I worry about that with my collection sometimes, that we don't get good growth because we're missing the natural microbiome. Have you ever looked at that?
We haven't. And part of the reason is that we're, I think that's something that can come later for some of the plants that we've worked with. But I can tell you that a lot of the people that we work with, they're just starved for just baseline information. I do have a colleague that works on orchid conservation, and I've been a part of some of those projects. And from that perspective, we've looked at microbionts and that type of thing. But for a lot of these other wildflower species, we just haven't been able to approach that. But that's a great question. So being able to conserve the seeds, but also if there's any mycorrhizal associations, that would be very important.
Kind of like saving the pieces.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
The Harper Ocala.
Mm-hmm.
What is the habitat for that?
It's a bog. Well, actually, it occurs in three different types of habitats. So a bog habitat. And then in an ecotone between a pine upland and a bog, and then on a roadside. So she looked at seed banking potential in all three of those habitats. She looked at germination phenology and in those three habitats as well. And then we did some lab work to look at seasonal temperatures. And
so the anecdotal stories about it not producing seeds from the wild,
all of them, all of them. And I think, well, and you have to, it's a small plant. And the seeds are maybe 2 millimeters long by 0.5 millimeter wide. So you can imagine how small the seedlings are. And, you know, there's a lot of competition, especially on the roadside. So trying to identify a Harper Ocala seedling and differentiate that from something else is nearly impossible.